Hello and welcome to The Pioneers, brought to you in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. I'm Robert Bound. This series explores some of the most innovative ideas in science, technology, conservation, medicine and beyond that are making the world we live in a better place. Joseph Cook is a glaciologist who spends a decent chunk of his year exploring ice sheets, particularly in Greenland. Over the past 10 years, he's been studying the microorganisms that discolour ice, turning it black or brown and making it melt faster, therefore speeding up climate change. He says that this will cause some glaciers around the world to disappear in the next few decades, and so his research is into how we slow that down. Cook's also been working with AI to map these vast, disappearing landscapes so we have a better idea of how they're changing. But as well as the science stuff, what Cook is good at is communicating what he's found out to normal people like you and I. He's collaborated with film teams, artists and musicians to bring these issues to a wider audience. His 2017 film, Ice Alive, was made with the funding he received from being a Rolex laureate, and it shows the complexities of these places that we might never visit and probably picture as an endless stretch of white nothingness. When Joseph's not in the Arctic, he lives in Margate on the Kent coast in the UK, which is where I went to meet him. We thought it would be nice to use the sea as a jumping-off point for the subject of climate change, but unfortunately, the weather had other ideas. Okay, so we were going to go and get some lovely salty sea sounds down by the pier and look at Anthony Gormley's sculpture that rises out of the sea as the tide goes down. Of course, there's another artistic intervention behind us. Some sort of strange choir. So we're going to go back to Joseph's house and continue the interview there. And today we're in the sitting room of Joseph Cook, glaciologist. Funny talking to a glaciologist, it's taken us a while, quite a long while in fact, to find the right place for acoustics. We were going to be down by the seaside where we could draw neat analogies between rising sea level and the British seaside. But we've come up above, well above sea level to talk to Joseph. Thanks for your time today. And I wanted to ask you first about science and funding and being a Rolex laureate. I wonder whether you could tell us a little bit about that relationship and what that's allowed you to do, where it's allowed you to go.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the first thing I'd say was that getting one of the Rolex Awards was a pivotal moment in my life and career. Traditional science funding is difficult to access for new researchers and young scientists, because you have to have such a demonstrable track record of previous funding, and there's so much emphasis on your place in the academic hierarchy that it's very difficult to access. But the Rolex Awards is different. It's unique in that respect, in that it looks for people's potential. And they go to great lengths to identify people that they think show promise for having future impact. The wonderful thing about that is that that has the potential to act as a springboard for young scientists' future careers, and enabling truly adventurous discovery science to happen that might not otherwise happen. One of the things that's often criticized about traditional national level science funding is that they tend to fund things that are to some extent foregone conclusions, because so much background knowledge has to be in place already that the outcome's kind of already known. Rolex takes the opposite approach, and is what are the big outstanding questions and the major unknowns, and funds them and supports them. That's really quite unique and special.
So you are, to a certain extent, you're going to fill us in a certain amount of detail about what it is, where you go and all the rest of it, and the importance of the projects on which you've been working. But to an extent, there's a bit of an outlier status to some of the things that you do and some of the things that the other laureates do, I suppose.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I think that whatever realm or whatever discipline you're looking at, be it science or entrepreneurship or business, big advances are made at the fringes. They're not made in the mainstream. And I think that the Rolex Awards appreciates that and aims to fund and aims to support and aims to give a platform to people that are operating in promising areas of the fringe of their discipline.
Okay. Well, we might come back to a bit of that kind of laureate lifestyle, as it were, and some of the connections that you've made through it near the end of our time today. But I wanted to get straight out onto the ice shelf, actually, with you, Joseph, because people will be intrigued to know what a glaciologist, not necessarily what they do, hopefully, but where they go. So what's life like out on the Greenland ice shelf? How do you put that into context? Such a vast thing. How do you know where you are? How do you kind of relate it when you get home?
It's difficult, to be honest. And I remember that the very first time that I set foot on the Greenland ice sheet, I was just astonished at how different it looked to how I expected. I was really expecting this big blank white landscape with very few features and a lack of colour. And it just wasn't like that. There's all kinds of topographic features. There are rivers, there are, you know, hummocks and ravines and rolling hills and plateaus. And a whole range of colours from dark, dark blacks and greys and purples all the way through to blues and neons and whites. And it's just this magical, magical environment that is unlike anywhere I've ever experienced anywhere else on the earth.
So there's a gap in the market, really, for a landscape artist to kind of go and sort of maximise some of the emotion and the sentiment, perhaps, of a place like
this. Well, actually, there are several really talented Greenland and Antarctic-specific landscape artists that create really, really beautiful, beautiful, stunning imagery. You know, you can search on Instagram or whatever and find these.
I can hear the
wonderful
sound of
images.
Keyboards clattering as we speak. And that's the thing. And I know that a lot of your research and a lot of the, you've teamed up with musicians and filmmakers, and you've been very public facing and kind of wise to be so, I guess. Do you consider it to be a problem that the vastness of some of this ice is just sort of unknowable to people? And is your research kind of trying to find a way to make it seem smaller, bring it closer to home somehow?
Yeah, I think to make it more relatable.
Yeah.
And I think that there's a couple of elements to that. And one is that when people are told about the scale of, for example, the Greenland ice sheet or the Antarctic ice sheet, they're told in terms of how many meters of sea level rise are locked away in each ice sheet. And over the next 100 years or in the next 1,000 years, how much of that is going to be released. And that's often, for the Greenland ice sheet, that's about 7 meters. For Antarctica, it's about 20 meters, which sounds very, very dramatic and frightening. But then also you hear about actual sea level rise and you hear that it's 0.5 millimeter or 1 millimeter. And the two things don't really connect. You think, well, if there's 20 meters locked away in Antarctica, but it's only rising by 1 millimeter, we've got no problem, right?
Yeah.
And I can understand that point of view because it's not well communicated. And the reality is that, yes, while there's 7 meters locked away in Greenland, 20 meters locked away in Antarctica, that sea level rise is not going to be released in any of our lifetimes, or probably our children or grandchildren's lifetimes. But it doesn't all have to be for us to have a big problem. And actually, 1 millimeter of sea level rise or 2 millimeters of sea level rise is problematic, not simply because the sea's rising by 1 millimeter or two, but because storm surges are going to get, they're going to inundate more land. More of the area around our coast is going to be unlivable because when there are winter storms, they're going to be inundated and river levels are going to rise and flooding on floodplains is going to be more frequent and higher magnitude. And it's those kind of knock-on effects that are really the dangers for society. But it's difficult to connect those first few statistics, which are the ones that are normally communicated, with real-world impact for people and people's homes and people's jobs and their livelihoods.
And I wanted to ask you about that. You've been good at making the science eye-catching. But I wonder if there's, for you and within the scientific community, always that kind of seesaw, that kind of resistance to the things that make newspaper headlines and that people will talk about and the reality of the science. Clearly, you can't make things up to make it seem worse than it is or more dramatic than it is. But are you kind of always kind of pushing the envelope in terms of how to be creative about the facts?
Yeah, absolutely.
And I mean that in the right possible way, you know what I mean?
Yeah, no, I understand. And you've tapped into a fundamental challenge of what it is to be a science and a science communicator, particularly now, a contemporary scientist and science communicator. And it's not something that's unique to climate change research either. If you take, for example, a corollary is artificial intelligence research. There's a camp of alarmists and there's a camp of what would be the opposite of an alarmist?
Well, kind of almost deniers, right? I mean, there's a lot of denial of a lot of the science that you make.
But there's a lot of scientists that are very strictly conveying what's factual, what's absolutely known, and are very reticent to make alarmist statements.
So we like the punctilious scientist, but we also like the creative and the communicator.
Yeah, exactly. And the danger is that the communicator pushes things too far into outside of realism. And there's a tension between the two. And I think every scientist is partly both. And different people are comfortable with different balance of speculation and hard published peer-reviewed fact.
Yeah.
And the reality is that the general public are not going to engage with the science literature. So it needs to be recommunicated in some engaging way. Ideally, that's not just through scientists communicating, but collaborating and informing musicians and writers and poets and, you know, all kinds of people with different skill sets that focus on the intangible and the immeasurable qualities rather than what can actually be measured by traditional science. And I think blending the two is critical. And I also think that it is important to convey simple, hard-hitting messages, but they should be rooted in fact.
When you think about the loss of ice, when you think about the browning of the ice, which is something you've been very interested in, I know. Do you feel emotional? Do you feel sentimental for these icy land masses or ice masses? As far as polar bears falling into the sea is concerned, is obviously an emotive part of a lot of nature documentaries. It's become a trope, a leitmotif of these things, perhaps rightly so. But the actual ice, some of this landscape, that it sounds like you're very fond of, icescape that you're very fond of. Do you feel sentimental toward it?
I am very fond of it, absolutely. And we've been talking mostly about the Greenland ice sheet because that's where I've done most of my work. And the reality is that the ice sheet itself is not going to completely disappear even over the next millennia. So that landscape will still exist. But that's not the case for glaciers elsewhere. Take, for example, British Columbia or some of the smaller glaciers in lower latitudes around the Alps or Austria. Mm-hmm. Even the high altitude glaciers in Africa around Kilimanjaro and those, they are genuinely threatened in our lifetime. You know, really in the next few decades, they're existentially threatened. They may not exist in a couple of decades. That is a major loss. That's a signifier of a changing world.
It is, isn't it? Because they're iconic things, they're famous things. When stuff like that changes, when we no longer live in the world in which the books we read when we were growing up are set.
Yeah.
That does something to you as a scientist, it does something to you as a person.
There's an irretrievable loss there. It takes millennia to build one of these glaciers, and then it doesn't take millennia to destroy one.
No, indeed. There's the rub, right?
Yeah.
We've skirted around talking about your work with artists and composers and stuff. You work with Hannah Peel, the electronic music artist particularly. Tell us about how that project started, how maybe that helped to kind of communicate some of the science as well.
Well, that project started out of my Rolex award, really. This was a project that I was working on the Greenland ice sheet to develop new drone technology for mapping the ice surface and for doing a better job of measuring and monitoring the surface change. And a side effect of that work was a lot of really beautiful imagery gathered from the sky with the drones. And I just felt there was a lot of potential in that imagery to convey the beauty and also the vulnerability of that environment to a new audience. But I don't really have the skills to do that myself. And it just so happened that I was on midweek on Radio 4 with Hannah. So we'd met briefly and I was aware of her work already. But after we'd met on the radio, I looked into the rest of her work and started exploring her back catalogue and that sort of thing and realised that the music that she creates is actually deeply analytical and rooted in science and philosophy.
So much maths in music, right?
Absolutely. So I just thought it would be incredible if she would be interested in collaborating or something. And I really thought there was no chance. I didn't even really expect a response. But I reached out and she was interested. And so we had a series of back and forths. I sent her some science papers and some images and some video from the field. And we had a series of conversations about how the ice sheet was changing and what the driving factors were. And she went away and created this piece of music that, with the aim of communicating the paradoxical sense of power and vulnerability of the ice and the nested feedbacks that are driving the ice surface to change. And it's kind of the ideal project for her, really, because her music is built up of many complex interconnecting layers of usually quite subtle noises and sounds. Mm. And it's just a very nice, it holds a mirror up to the ice sheet. It's a nice analogy for the kind of nested feedbacks and processes that are going on the ice.
And the satisfaction of working on a project like that, to see it come to fruition, to hear it come to fruition, to have something very obvious to share with the world that hits people harder than the facts. Going back to that resistance between the kind of the evergreen kind of popular facts and the real stuff, that must be particularly satisfying, to be able to transfer all your learning and knowledge and research into something that sings almost.
Yeah, an entirely new medium for me, and especially linking the music with the imagery. It's a new audience that are open to a new medium.
Yeah.
And there's going to be a whole group of people that are Hannah Peel fans that haven't, you know, maybe no background no interest in glaciology whatsoever, but will see
until
the work.
Now.
That will see the work.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That's immensely, immensely satisfying.
And going back to the kind of romance of Greenland and all the ice, there's a kind of job, I mean, this is the job of nature documentaries and scientists, sits halfway between the two, of how much you sort of anthropomorphize nature and the natural world and how much you just let it kind of sing for its supper. You photograph it and you let it do its own bidding. Where do you kind of sit on that sliding scale, Joseph?
That's an interesting question. I think I probably fall towards the latter end of letting the nature speak for itself. I'm very sensitive to that issue because I've been a fan of James Lovelock and his Gaia hypothesis and that kind of research, the extended phenotype. They've been widely criticized for anthropomorphizing too much and giving an unrealistic view of what's really going on scientifically. So I've always been quite sensitive to that issue of not assuming anything teleological or not assuming that there's a decision-making process going on with something that is not non-biological. However, I do think it's very difficult to be completely scientific and still engage people. So I think there's a degree of latitude, there's a degree of flexibility that is required. But there's a responsibility that comes along with it not to mislead people into misunderstandings. And I think that's a difficult tightrope to walk along.
We'll field the calls from Disney on your behalf and let them know what they say. So I wanted to ask you about the difference between being out in the field and the research that you do on the screen and in the lab and all the rest of it. It seems to me, you can forgive my ignorance for a moment, that it must be far more exciting to be out in the field with all your kind of Canada Goose gear on and all the rest of it than in the lab. But tell us kind of what that's like and actually the amount of time spent in each.
Well, the amount of time spent in the field varies year by year. I often spend several months of each year away camped on usually the Greenland ice sheet, but also elsewhere. And yeah, you're right. From an outside perspective, it seems like that's the most exciting part of the job. And in a lot of ways it is. But I wouldn't be happy in this job if I was only happy doing the field work. Because in reality, that makes up a maximum of 20% of my year. And the rest of the time is really spent behind a computer writing code and programming and analyzing data. And if I didn't get an equal amount of joy out of doing that, then I wouldn't be able to do this.
Somewhere between ice burn and screen burn then you've got.
yeah. Right, exactly, exactly. Okay. But honestly, it's such a diverse profession in that I, in 1 month, be out on an ice sheet with no connectivity whatsoever, no internet, no phone, just the basics to survive in that environment. And then the next week I'm working with cloud computing and artificial intelligence and really high technology. And then the week after, it's all about public facing stuff and going into schools and recommunicating stuff, getting the fundamental point out of what we're doing and recommunicating it at various different levels, from school children all the way up to sort of PhD level classes in universities. It's just so diverse and it requires so many different approaches and so many different ways to think. I think that in itself is the satisfying part about it, not just the being out on the ice part.
No, well, it keeps you very honest, right? Having to kind of tap dance between so many different disciplines. I mean, it's a lot of stuff, and I guess it's all empowering public knowledge of your subject matter, isn't it?
I guess there's two aspects to it, and one is generating new knowledge and the other is communicating that new knowledge, and one can't really exist without the other.
No, well, that's why we get the opportunity to be having this kind of conversation today. Before we talk about, I wanted to talk about AI and sort of big computers and all the rest of it, but we can't leave the ice without knowing what you pack, because people want to know what's in your rucksack. People might well have watched your film. When you kind of go, you said that sometimes you go and you don't have any connectivity, you know, so you can leave the phone at home, although I'm sure you take some very good pictures. We know you take some very good pictures. But what else is in that rucksack? You can be as personal as you like.
Okay. Well, the absolute essentials are my Kindle, loaded up with books.
Okay. Yeah.
Without a doubt. Although I have taken it a couple of times on winter camping expedition, and the LCD is just frozen solid.
Oh, right.
Yeah. Did you change a page? And the last one
doesn't still pretty
leave.
Good. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Paper. A couple of backup paper books, just in case. Yeah. Absolutely. You've got to have a couple of little luxuries in there, your favorite bar of chocolate and maybe some nice coffee or something like that.
Yeah.
Just for when you need it, when you've been out there a few months and you just need a little pick-me-up.
Keep you sane.
You got to have something. And then obviously all the normal stuff you'd expect.
And in terms of kind of walking along the ice, what are you wearing? I mean, how many layers are you wearing on the... I know that, you know, I think you start out from Svalbard and Norway often and you get up to Greenland. What are the changes of clothes that you kind of need to have?
It depends, because sometimes I'll camp there in the summer, in which case it's not that extreme, really, the weather. The big danger is these Pitarac storms coming in, which are hard to predict, and then they can hang around for a few days and be quite destructive. But really, the temperature is between -5 and 10 degrees even. So okay. It's, in terms of the temperature, it's not that extreme. But a winter camp is quite different. It's in some ways easier because it's dry, because everything's frozen. But the temperature could be -35 and the winds could be very strong. We experienced a few winter storms that have been quite full on, actually. Gale force winds and -35. And
this is all, and you're all intense and stuff. I mean,
we're all intense. Yeah.
Okay. We won't ask you the obvious question about. So.
Well, we did a BBC interview not a long time ago, and they joined us on the ice, and we made a range of different products for them, for iPlayer and BBC.
Uh-huh.
And they were very popular, but one in particular, how do you go to the toilet on the Greenland ice sheet, was the most watched item on BBC News that week.
Well, I'm glad we've at least partially managed to elegantly sidestep it, only partially. So you said that, you know, 20% of your time actually is spent on the ice, out in the field, as it were, and there's a lot of code, there's a lot of computing that's part of your job. It'd be nice to know a bit about that and AI and how AI and sort of big computing, as it were, affects your work, influences your work, and what it'll do in the future. Maybe you can give us a little bit of a kind of a potted history or an idea of how you're using it and how it's going to change how scientific research is done.
Well, for me, this was born out of a realization that being scientists in a camp making measurements can only tell you so much about processes that are operating at the scale of a continent-sized ice sheet. If we want to understand processes that are going on at a scale bigger than what we can see from the ground, we need to take to the sky. And I've been doing that using drones and also satellites. Now, the problem with that is that generates a huge, huge volume of data. And oftentimes the questions that we're asking about the ice surface are subtle, ambiguous, and difficult to pick apart. And this is really ideal territory for AI and big computing resources. And this is something that recently I've had some progress with through a grant from Microsoft and National Geographic that started with seed funding from my Rolex award, where we've been developing new drone technology to image the ice surface with a special camera that is sensitive to the same wavelengths of light as some of the satellites that image the ice sheet as well. And that means that we can train artificial intelligence algorithms on data that we collect on the ground. And then the drone acts as a bridge, a scale bridge between these centimeter scale ground measurements and kilometer scale satellite measurements. Wow. And using Microsoft's Azure cloud computing platform, we're able to digest all of that data and make inferences, more than inferences, make direct measurements at the scale of the entire ice sheet, which otherwise would be impossible.
So you're not having to assume that what is happening in one part is happening in the whole part. I mean, you can let me know or not whether that's bad science, but now you can virtually see the whole thing and you can see the effect of different things on the whole sheet, as it were.
Yeah, that's basically the idea. What we would do is we would visit enough sites, enough sampling locations on the ice sheet to be confident that we can make assumptions between those sites.
Uh-huh.
And then we'll use satellite observations so that we don't actually visit everywhere on the ice sheet to infer what's going on. And we can use big computing power, distributed computing in the cloud, to churn through terabytes of data in a relatively short amount of time. And suddenly that's become democratized, it's become accessible, it's become affordable, not just for people in big universities with big grants that can afford an on-site HPC, high performance computing resource, but for anyone. And that's exactly what we've been doing. So I've been going out making ground measurements, manual measurements on the ice, flying a drone to add an XY dimension to those point measurements, and then using that to validate satellite observations. And with that workflow, we can now, at an unprecedented scale and level of detail, watch what's going on the glacier surface, but not only watch it, explain it.
Those high performance computers and those algorithms, do they let you, they presumably program through and you can tell the future to a certain extent with these things?
Well, at the moment it's about explaining the present, but yeah. The obvious next step.
But the
step,
models unfold.
Absolutely. This is about getting the fundamental process level knowledge that will allow us to make better predictions about the melting of the ice sheet and therefore sea level rise. Now, in the immediate future.
It's amazing stuff. And presumably, maybe you can let listeners know if these algorithms decide themselves what are the important data sets to draw from this, or whether that is still a human process, or maybe it's a mixture of the two.
This is an interesting question that we could have the entire...
I'm not trying to put you out of a job here by saying, the computer does everything. Yeah.
we could probably spend the entire podcast talking about just this issue. And I think that in terms of public understanding of AI, there's a critical divide to be drawn between artificial intelligence, which is a real technology that exists now that mm-hmm. is enjoying a boom period, and artificial general intelligence, which remains a fiction. Artificial general intelligence is a system that we would try to replicate human level cognizance and decision making capabilities. There's no way to build that yet. We don't know how, but that's where the fear of Skynet and evil robots and that kind of thing comes from.
Yeah.
What we have at the moment is the real world artificial intelligence is systems of pattern recognition and decision making that are based on showing a computer lots and lots of examples of something and saying, right now you should know how to identify that thing. Or a system of rewards and punishments, say optimize for getting rewards, not punishments.
Okay.
Right. So what we've done
is... I love
is,
incentives for computers. I'd love to know how this works.
Well, it's called reinforcement learning, and that's how they teach robots to walk, for example. And that's what it's used a lot in driverless vehicles, mm-hmm. for example. But what we're doing is using the drone imagery and the satellite imagery and saying, look at the surface. And here's a data set that we collected on the ground where we have actually taken the ice away and measured it in the lab, so we know precisely what its composition is. And now when you look at the drone imagery and the satellite imagery, you should be able to identify what you're looking at based on the samples that we've analyzed and shown you in the lab. So it's really a case of getting as many samples as possible, showing them to the computer effectively, and saying, now learn what these are, so that when you see them again in our satellite imagery, you'll be able to identify them.
Joseph Cook, the hard taskmaster of the AI world. Now you've seen these data, now learn. And amongst the some of your colleagues and some of the people that we might have seen in your films and things, does everyone get excited about the same thing? Do glaciologists get excited about the same breakthroughs in knowledge? Are they worried by the same rising temperatures, etc.?
I think fundamentally, yes. The big questions are common across the discipline, really. And ultimately, they're all about how quickly ice is going to disappear in the future under a warming climate. However, there's a lot of sub-disciplines within glaciology where some people are just interested in, say, mass balance modelling. Some people are just interested in snow or some very specific aspect of snow. Some people are interested in interactions with the ocean. For me, I'm interested in that big error bar around sea level rise up to the end of the century, because I think that a lot of that uncertainty can be attributed to our lack of knowledge and lack of understanding of the color of ice, because that's the primary thing that determines how quickly it melts, because darker things warm up in the sun quicker. And surprisingly, we actually don't do a very good job of describing that mathematically at the moment. And I think if we can resolve that uncertainty, then we can have a major improvement in our accuracy of prediction of deglaciation and sea level rise to the end of the century.
I mean, this is something you've focused on very specifically, isn't it? And finding microorganisms mm-hmm. in the ice that are discoloring the ice, and the warmer they get, the darker they get, or the more proliferated they are, and that leads to a blackening or a browning of all this ice, yep. which is a mad thing to see. I mean, having watched your film, it's a very unusual thing when people think it is just a vastness of white. It's very different to that.
It still astonishes me after 10 years of working in this area that invisibly small creatures are influencing the fate of a continent-sized ice sheet. The effect of the unimaginably small is unimaginably large.
Yes,
that's Louis Pasteur quote. And he was absolutely right. And this is a perfect example of that.
And seeing that, and go, I mean, again, that's something to do with the sort of public embrace of your science. It's a tough thing also to kind of communicate the, other than saying, well, I think you use the analogy that if you wear a black t-shirt in the summertime, you're going to get a lot hotter than if you wear a white one. Imagine then what that's doing to the ice. I suppose you're always searching with these browning icebergs versus the white ones, the classy white ones, as they are in the popular imagination. You're always searching for that way to communicate that fact, right?
Yeah, I guess that's it. It's about finding analogies that people can relate to, mm-hmm. but that also convey the reality of the process that's going on. The black and white t-shirt one has almost become a bit of a cliche now.
I know you're wearing a black shirt today. It's good. I'm glad you're true to the film, you know. And as we said, I knew we'd sort of come back to the seaside, the British seaside, as it is where we are in Margate here, Joseph. Is there anything communicable down here as the waves lap against the Kentish sand that we can learn from your research? Could you bring children, adults, anyone down to your part of the world here and explain how the world is changing looking at the sea here?
Yeah, well, I think the obvious thing is that we're right next to the ocean and it's rising.
Yeah.
And I think you got the train here today, and on the way from the train station to my house, you will have walked predominantly along sea defences and coastal defences that have been built relatively recently. And I think the simple message is that those coastal defences are more important and going to get more important in the future, because the sea level is going to rise, storm surges are going to be stronger, more frequent, inundate more land, coastal erosion is going to accelerate, and people with coastal properties are going to be more at risk than they used to be, insurance premiums will go up, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So all of these things that seem very distant and are localized to the Arctic and to Greenland and the Antarctic are not really localized at all. They're global issues. And for people like us in Margate that live on the coast and are vulnerable to coastal erosion and coastal storms, they're real world, real time issues.
And before we go, I'd like for you to take us back to the ice. How do you feel about it? I feel like you have moments, as much as you're there for scientific purposes and research, I kind of feel that you love it. What's your relationship with the place that you've most commonly gone to for scientific research? Because it feels like a lot of love for that part of the world comes through on some of the spoken word projects you've done, some of the talks you do, and the films you've made.
That's true. I do love that environment. And I've had fun there. I've had scary moments there. I've had deep moments there. I've had bad times there too. And I think it's something to do with the isolation, something to do with the relative blankness of the environment, maybe the 24-hour daylight or a 24-hour darkness, depending on when you're there, the northern lights and the potential for wildlife encounters and that kind of thing that just make it a magical, magical place. I do love it, and I'm scared for it, because it's both beautiful, enormous, powerful, but also vulnerable and sensitive to our actions. Just like the invisibly small microbes are affecting the fate of a continent-sized ice sheet, as I said a minute ago, our actions affect it too. And it's not about one of us or one action that we have, but the emergent macroscale effects that we have as a species are causing this beautiful environment to be existentially threatened.
That was Joseph Cook, a former Rolex laureate, and next week on The Pioneers we'll be concluding this half of the series with Emma Camp, who's on the hunt for the world's toughest corals to help reverse the devastation to large reefs. And this programme was produced by Holly Fisher, and I've been Robert Bound, and thank you very much for listening.